Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, yes, indeedy, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here, ruining your day since 1963 by busting myths and taking names. Listen, this week we're going to talk about religious relics. My favorite religious relic, the one that hangs over my altarpiece in my office, is a set of old guitar strings from St. Stephen of Stills. But that's my religion. We're here with Dr. John Giebfried. He's going to explain to us the famous Christian relics of the medieval and ancient past. And of course, we have to do that over the wonderfulness of the interwebs. And I'm going to skip over there right now and connect with Dr. Giebfried.
Okay, Professor, thank you so much for joining us again. Thanks for coming back to the bunker.
Ah, I love it in here. I see that you've redecorated the walls since last I was here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Churchill's still hanging up there, though.
Well, we have to look at something when we're debunking all his quotes. But you know what interests me so much, and I think what interests the Buzzkiller so much about this idea of Christian relics is whether they are mythological. There are so many stories that they sound just like run-of-the-mill history myths. But then we don't really even know, most of us at least, don't even know what a relic is. So let's start there at the beginning. What is a Christian relic?
Well, in Christian doctrine, there are three types or three classes of relics. A first class relic is a portion of the body of a saint. So bone, flesh, hair, something like that. Mm-hmm. A second class relic is an item that used to belong to a saint, an article of their clothing, their Bible, their walking stick, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Finally, there are third class relics, which are objects that are touched to a first or second class relic. So if you go and you visit a first or a second class relic, sometimes you pilgrims will touch something they own to those relics, and then they can take home a third class relic, at least, which gives you a little bit of something to take with you, I guess.
Oh, so presumably the third class relic carries with it, by touching the first or second class relic, carries with it some of the sanctity of those first or second class relics.
Yeah.
Why are relics so special? They're not very common in other religions. Why are they so special in the Christian religion?
Well, in some ways, relic culture is universal, not just to all religions, but to all people. We all keep mementos and keepsakes from people or places or events that have helped shape our lives. And in secular contexts as well as religious, that they all do the same thing. They help us remember that the t-shirt from a contest or the souvenir mug or magnet, it helps you remember to keep something in your brain, that keeping something of a deceased family member helps bring them to mind. And the relics are serving the same function. They help us remember the saint and the importance of their life and their life sacrifice on behalf of others. And over time, the Catholic Church recognized the value of relics to help people sort of contemplate their faith and offered sort of spiritual rewards to go on pilgrimage to see these relics. So the church says relic culture is important, so we should encourage this and tell people, go and see these. Let these saints make a difference in your life. And some of these relics are known to bring miracles to those who sort of pray before them. In the Middle Ages, you have the bones of St. Thomas Becket in Canterbury that everyone from England goes and tries to get miracle to have the miracles that supposedly happen at the tomb. And their relics are always good for everyone, and they're great for sort of local economies. To have a superstar saint in your area really will bring in people forever. And my favorite story about this is that the great and rather portly Dominican saint Thomas Aquinas was one day wandering through Italy, and people recognized him. And they said, hey, isn't that Thomas Aquinas? And the next thing you know, everyone said, oh, we know that he's going to be a saint one day. And people start coming up to him, trying to grab off his clothes and pieces of his hair and everything else, trying to get a piece of him to sort of leave behind in the town.
While he's still alive.
While he's, I mean, there are people who, while they're still alive, everyone knows what way they're going. And we'll try to grab that. And Thomas manages to make it away from the crowd more or less in one piece. But there certainly are many cases of relic theft in the Middle Ages for local economy or local prestige. Famously, Venice steals the body of Saint Mark from Muslim-controlled Alexandria, sneaking it out in a barrel of pork to avoid Muslim customs inspectors. No, and I was just going to say this is just one of those ancillary benefits of why everyone wanted relics, that they're good for the economy and they're good for your soul.
Okay, so what sort of myths, historical myths especially, do people sort of cling on to about these relics?
Well, I guess there's sort of generally two sides of the coin on relics. And when you go towards absolutes, where you run into myths. And so you have the case that some people believe that all these relics are true, and others believe they're all fakes. There's nothing true here. And as historians, you have to say that you need to have a nuanced view. Right. The all fake view comes back to the idea that medieval people weren't sophisticated. They just believed whatever you told them. And if someone said they had the bones of St. Peter, then then no one would question them. Actually, in the Middle Ages, they had a very well-built system of sort of tagging relics that with little sort of signed and initialed pieces of parchment attached to all of them, sort of attesting their authenticity. And there were written transfer documents of, I got this relic from this person who gave it to this person. And this system was so sort of well-built out that I can say that sort of the vast majority of all relics that purport to date from an era, the era of Charlemagne or later. Perhaps you can even push it to the era of Constantine.
Hang on one second. Let's give the buzzkillers a couple of dates for those things, so they've got that in their heads.
So Charlemagne famously becomes Holy Roman Emperor in the year 800.
Right.
And that's sort of the birth of modern, I guess, medieval Europe, formally coming out of, I guess, the worst of what's sometimes called the Dark Ages, that you have sort of an institutionalized, strong, stable Christian medieval states in the Middle East from that, in Europe from that point onward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then Constantine, of course, the first Christian emperor, and that, and at this point, we're in the 300s AD. So at least by the era of Charlemagne onwards, there is a continuous chain of custody of saints' bodies in Christian hands, and a continuous collection of records that say, yes, this person is buried here. We give this relic to this church here. We give this relic to this church here. So for all medieval saints, there is almost no historical doubt that the relics that purport to be theirs actually are theirs. So St. Francis is really buried in Assisi. Thomas Becket is buried in Canterbury, or at least he was until Henry VIII dug him up. And that way we know that those relics are genuine. The problem is there are still forgers out there in the Middle Ages. Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales has a famous scene with a corrupt cleric known as a pardoner who goes around passing off pig bones as relics. So there is forgery going on, but this is forgery of relics that purport to date from an era before sort of continuous Christian control and government over the bones that are purported to be held.
Okay, so we have this is what historians really look for, and that is reliable documentation for the things you're talking about from Becket's time, from Charlemagne's time, from Constantine's time, more or less, in addition to these obviously fake ones. But what about before Charlemagne, before Constantine, going way back into Christian history?
Well, that's where it gets harder to prove. So yeah. You get a whole bunch of relics that are famously found by Constantine's mother, the great ancient relic hunter, St. Helena, that she converts to Christianity. Her son converts to Christianity, and then he becomes emperor, and she spends the rest of her life going around the Holy Land and collecting all the relics she can find and then bringing them either back to Rome or to her son's new capital in Constantinople. These are things like the true cross, the crown of thorns, the relics of a lot of the early the apostles, that the spear that pierces Christ's side, that she finds all these major things. And the key question as to whether these are real or not is whether or not you can believe as a historian that early Christians were able to, one, get these relics after Jesus died, and then hold them for 300-400 years until sort of St. Helena and the early relic hunters came and found them.
Yes, and we...
And the problem is in some cases, there's some good evidence that early Christians might have, and in others, that they might not have.
Oh, but that's exactly what we're looking for. We're looking at the difference between good evidence and bad evidence, right?
Yeah. And so just sort of two examples of this are the famous tombs of two of the apostles, St. Peter and St. James. So St. Peter is crucified in Rome in the reign of Nero. And we have his tomb discovered in the time of Constantine and Helena and turned into St. Peter's Basilica in the exact same spot that the Vatican is today. Right. And what we find there is when the Vatican excavated the tomb of St. Peter, they found ancient Roman graffiti that basically said, Peter is buried here. And when they opened the tomb and checked it, they found the skeleton of a very old man who can be dated to around the time that St. Peter would have lived. So if you ask whether or not the tomb of St. Peter in Rome is really St. Peter, there is a very strong possibility of it. The counterexample... Yes. Is the tomb of St. James. It's the famous pilgrimage church in Spain of Santiago de Compostela. And when it comes to the evidence there, there's basically no chance that the historical St. James was buried there. That James is martyred in Jerusalem, give or take the 40s AD. And then in 814, a hermit by the name of Pelagius sees some strange lights in the sky, and he interprets this to mean that St. James is buried in this one spot. He digs up, he finds some bones. This catches on with some local nobles and then eventually the king in that part of Spain, who build up the tradition that, yep, St. James' body was magically taken to the far corners of the Mediterranean without any documents. And after 800 years, he just magically reappears to this hermit with sort of no documentation. One of the interesting theories about this this St. James tomb, this very famous pilgrimage site in Santiago that millions of people still go on the famous Carmina, going across France and Spain, walking to visit it every summer, is that it's actually not the tomb of a Christian saint, but actually the tomb of a Spanish heretic by the name of Priscillian of Avila. This is actually first presented as a theory by a very, very well-respected Oxford professor by the name of Henry Chadwick, who was Regis Chair there. And he argued that this sort of Spanish heretic who was condemned by the Pope and executed for sorcery and whose tomb was known to be venerated by his followers in exactly that part of Spain might actually be the same spot that millions of people every year go to. So instead of going to the tomb of a saint, they're going to the tomb of a heretic sorcerer.
Well, that's very interesting because, of course, the saints live on, you know, after Jesus dies. And so there is a more of a, if you will, chance that relics of saints could survive. But what about the relics of Jesus and Mary themselves?
In this case, that a lot of them are very clearly forgeries. My favorite example here is a relic known as the Holy Priapus. To keep this a family show, I'll just say that because Jesus was resurrected, there are no bones of Jesus to be given as relics. And aside from his blood and his hair, there's nothing aside from his blood and his hair you can have. There is only sort of one part of his body that could have survived as a relic. And that's the part that, as a practicing Jew, Joseph and Mary would have had removed from Jesus when he was a baby boy.
That would be his foreskin.
I'll let your readers sort of, your listeners fill in what that is. And somehow, no fewer than a dozen medieval churches claim to have this one part of the baby Jesus. Understandably, this drew a lot of critique during the Reformation, and the Catholic Church itself basically told all the churches who had these relics to make them go away, and that they sort of magically vanished, never came out of the archives for pilgrims to see again. The last one actually didn't vanish from a church in Italy until the 20th century.
Well, what then is a sort of historian's stand on the very famous Shroud of Turin?
So this is a rather delicate matter. So we talked about sort of this unbroken sort of chain of custody, and we do have that for the Shroud of Turin dating back to the 14th century. When the shroud was carbon dated, the carbon dating gave us a medieval date that's sort of close to that 14th century date. But that could have been the result of a medieval fire around that time. And if it got sort of the carbon from the flames and the fire and the burning, that might explain why it has a medieval carbon date. For me, the best evidence that the Shroud of Turin is older than just a medieval forgery is that are the crucifixion marks on the wrists. And one of the weird things about crucifixion we don't think about is that if you crucify someone through the hands, they don't sort of stay to the cross. They'll sort of fall off. But if you crucify them through the wrists, they'll stand. However, in sort of translating the Bible from Greek to Latin, that the way the translation works, that most people thought you crucified people through your hands. So in most medieval depictions, you have hand marks. Whereas in the Shroud of Turin, you have wrist crucifixion marks, which would be accurate, which may suggest that this was not a medieval forgery, or at least it was done by someone who knew a whole lot more about crucifixion than any other sort of medieval artist did at the time. And one theory of why the Shroud of Turin could be older than the 14th century is that it's actually an unfolded version of a much older and well-known and more well-documented relic, something called the Mandylion of Edessa, which we have known about and can trace back to about the 400s. This is a folded cloth, the Mandylion, with Christ's face on it. This isn't to be confused with another relic that's in Rome, that's Veronica's Veil, which is sort of a wiping of Jesus' face taken by St. Veronica.
Yeah, she handed him a cloth when he was taking the cross up, and he wiped his face with it, and that's where that story comes from, yeah.
Yeah, so this is yet another image of Christ's face. Yeah. And this Mandylion of Edessa originally was in Edessa. It went to Constantinople for centuries, but then crusaders took it back to France after the Fourth Crusade, and it was given to St. Louis IX of France. Mm-hmm. Now, most people who believe in the historicity of the Shroud argue, following the arguments of an English amateur scholar by the name of Ian Wilson, that the Shroud is actually the same thing as the Mandylion. It's just the Mandylion was sort of a folded up version of the shroud only to show the face. But if you unfolded it, you'd have the whole shroud. And when it got back to France, it was unfolded. And that was the shroud. However, this argument was recently very, very thoroughly debunked in a book about the Shroud of Turin by an Italian historian by the name of Andrea Nicolotti, and who goes by sort of point by point all the accounts, everything Wilson had argued, and basically conclusively says the Mandylion and the Shroud are two totally different things, And even if they had been the same thing, Paris's Saint-Chapelle, which is built by Louis IX of France for the Mandalion and the Crown of Thorns and large pieces of the cross and all these relics that are taken back from Constantinople, that relic, the Mandalion, stays in there till the French Revolution, long after the Shroud of Turin shows up. So they're just really, you really can't argue that there's a link.
But does that make the Shroud a fake?
It means that the only plausible story at this point about how the true relic ended up in Turin is not true. As a historian, I'll defer to the scientists to see if they can prove or disprove it based on age. But there is no, at this point, historical evidence to date it back anything more than the 14th century.
You know, I think this is a good place to take a little break because we need to remind the Buzzkillers that we're so stoked that this podcast and the Buzzkill Institute is sponsored by Harry's Razors. Harry's is our first major sponsor of the show, and we've been so very pleased to talk about them because we've been using them since they started, practically. One of the reasons I use Harry's is that big ripoff razor companies always make small changes in their blades. They tweak them a little way, and they raise their already high prices. Harry's is different. Harry's doesn't believe in upcharging. They're not going to charge you another dollar because this razor once touched the hem of St. Paul of Tarsus and is therefore a relic. They've made their razors better and better, and the prices have remained the same. Harry's charges a fraction of what the ripoff razor companies charge, and the Buzzkillers at Harry's mail the razors right to you on a regular basis that you set up with your schedule. I love the razors. They have a soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places. I use that all the time, lubricating strip, and a nice, comfortable, textured handle. Their prices are still just $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more that you'll pay at the ripoff drugstore. They do this because they own their own factory in Germany where they make the blades, and they produce the highest quality razors themselves, cut out the middleman, cut out the relic merchants in the middle, and sell them online for a half price of the ripoff razor companies. Harry's has a special offer. Most of you Buzzkillers already know about it. They've told us that a lot of you have already signed up using Buzzkill as the code at checkout. That's great. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. That's harrys.com. The free trial set includes a razor, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. You just pay a little bit for shipping. I think it's $3. Plus, just for you Buzzkillers, again, enter the code Buzzkill at checkout, and you'll get their post-shave balm for free with your order. The Pulse Shave Balm is great. You'll look better, and your face will feel better all day when you use it. Your subscription plan is customizable in terms of shipping frequency, and of course, you can cancel at any time. Let me repeat that, Buzzkillers. Go to harrys.com, enter the code Buzzkill, 2 Z's, 2 L's, at checkout. You'll get a great razor, blades, shave cream, and the Post Shave Balm for free. And the lady Buzzkill in your life will certainly like it. Do it now. Start enjoying a whole new world of better and more affordable shaves. And now, back to Professor Giebfried and the fascinating topic of relics. This sort of brings up an interesting sort of question in my mind, that there might be unintentional fake relics, that people thought these certain things were real and then, if you will, promoted them, and I mean that in the most respectful way, promoted them as relics, but they didn't know that they weren't actual relics.
Yeah, so there's actually a few good examples of this. My favorite is the story of Saint Ursula, who was martyred by the Huns around the year 400 in the city of Cologne, along with several sort of virgin companions. Now, the traditional number for these virgin companions is actually 11,000 virgins, which would make it one of, if not the largest, mass martyrdom in Christian history. And this is probably actually a typo. Up until around the year 900, the number was actually 11, but it was 11. And then there was a sort of a medieval manuscript sort of shorthand to add 1,000 instead of a line and a dash. And it looks like it was copied wrong, and 11 became 11,000.
Yeah.
And so it looked like lots and far too many people were being martyred with her. This tradition continued on, and later in the Middle Ages, when they were building a new cathedral for Cologne, they ran into a Roman-era graveyard, and they saw all these piles and piles of bones together, all sort of put together, and they thought, this can only be sort of St. Ursula and the 11,000 virgins. So they took all these bones, they kept many in Cologne, and then they sent it off to neighboring regions as sort of religious gifts. And this was just, I think what you were saying, sort of a pious mistake, an unintentional fraud.
Yeah, clearly they're not trying to profit on these things or make any sort of great theological hay out of them. It's just that, you know, they just got this wrong. They sort of jumped to the conclusion that it was Ursula in the 11,000.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In this case, I know that the Archbishop of Cologne gives a large chunk of the a large number of these supposed 11,000 virgins to his sister, who's an abbess of a monastery nearby, and then she gives it off to some of her friends, and they're all sort of being spread out. We have all these new saints that, as we build new churches, everyone needs some relics for their churches, that it's it just seems to be a mistake.
Now, but when the Reformation comes along, a lot of Reformation scholars, Reformation clerics and theologians, they don't see these things as mistakes. They don't see the cult of relics, if you will, as a legitimate thing, right?
No, that one of the major critiques of people, both Catholic and Protestant, during the time of the Reformation was how the Catholic Church handled relics. And they had a lot of sort of great one-liners that, the most famous was a line by actually the Catholic thinker Erasmus, who it was later rephrased by John Calvin. And he said that there is enough wood from the true cross to fill an entire ship's cargo. And this is often remembered wrong as saying there's enough wood of the true cross to build a ship. Or my favorite misquote of it is there's enough wood from the true cross to rebuild Noah's Ark.
You mean they're saying there are enough slivers of the true cross. There are enough slivers of the true cross that are presented as actual relics of the true cross that if you put them all together, they would form these massive cargoes.
Yeah, so it's actually interesting that there are so many pieces of the true cross out there that it does make sense to be skeptical. But we have to understand that these pieces of the true cross are all very, very small.
Yeah.
And actually, in the 19th century, a French scholar named Charles Rouault de Fleury actually set himself the task of finding and measuring all the known pieces of the true cross all throughout Europe. So what he went and did is first he calculated the size of a full Roman crucifixion cross, which he said was about 10,900 cubic inches or 3.5 square feet. You sort of put it together in a square
of wood,
and he went across Europe measuring every piece he could find, and the number of pieces when he put it all together, he found 240 cubic inches or 0.26 square feet. He then took a very aggressive estimate and said that he multiplied it by 10. He assumes that there's 10 times more wood of the cross out there than he was found. That was either lost over the centuries or was in private hands, or he just missed it, saying there's 10 times more than I found out there. And even if you did that, he came to 2,400 cubic inches, which is still less than a quarter the size of a full Roman crucifixion cross.
Yeah. So does that mean all the fragments of the true cross are genuine?
No, it doesn't. But it does quash the idea that there's sort of widespread forgery.
Right.
And as for the veracity of that cross itself, it's my academic opinion that probably most of those teeny tiny fragments all do come from the cross found by St. Helena in Jerusalem in the time of Constantine and have sort of been carried back and forth.
Uh-huh.
Whether or not the cross that St. Helena found is the same cross that Jesus was crucified on is a matter of faith and not for me to decide on that matter.
Okay, but it's not the slivers that someone took off, you know, a baseball bat and died to make it look like, you know, ancient wood. This really was ancient wood. Whether there was Jesus' cross or not is another matter.
Yeah, I almost all of it, I would say, is probably ancient wood.
Right, right. Okay, one of my other favorites are the relics of the Virgin Mary's breast milk. What would tell the buzzkillers about that?
Yeah, John Calvin had a great line about this. He said, had Mary been a cow all her life, she could never have produced such a quantity of milk. And so that when it comes to the breast milk, when you look at those samples, you find out that they're actually not milk, most of them. And it's not just medieval people passing off random breast milk as the milk of of Mary.
Would this be dried residue, presumably? Dried residue of milk? I mean, they're not obviously still in liquid form.
No, actually, it's not milk at all. That it's actually limestone. And this is a relic. Yeah, this is a relic that's taken from sort of a sacred grotto that is in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. And the limestone roof has dripped this sort of white residue for centuries.
Oh, okay.
Which is sort of kept and given to pilgrims as sort of, it's believed to be sort of the miraculous milk from the Virgin Mary, because this is the chapel near where Christ was born. And so this has been this limestone has been held to be either literally or symbolically the milk of Mary, and it's this sort of tradition that's being brought back. It's not people passing off breast milk of the Virgin Mary. This is part of an older tradition. So it's not Mary's breast milk, but it's not just sort of an abject. It's not just an abject forgery that people are trying to pass off.
Right. Okay. Another one of Calvin's critiques that you had pointed out to me earlier was that about John the Baptist and John the Baptist's head, and that they're all spread out all over Europe, all in various churches and crypts of churches.
Yeah, he has this great quote. He says, "Poets tell us about a king of Spain who had three heads. If our manufacturers of relics could say the same of John the Baptist, it would greatly assist in their lies. But as such a fable does not exist, how are they to get out of this dilemma? I shall not press them too hard by inquiring how could this head have been so divided and distributed, or how it could have been procured from Constantinople. I should merely observe that either St. John must have been a miracle, or that those who possess so many parts of his head are a set of the most audacious cheats." In effect, he's accusing them of having just an endless supply of John the Baptist heads. You chop one off, oh, look, here's another head for it to give up.
That reminds me of the ancient myth about Hercules and the Hydra, chopping off one head and another one springs up to attack him.
Yeah, no. So yeah, John the Baptist as a Hydra is an interesting thought. But this is actually some of my own original work that in my dissertation that I did a lot of work on relic transfers from Constantinople to the West, and I looked at this issue of John the Baptist's head, and that if you break it down, what's actually going on is that there is this ancient relic that has been in Constantinople since sort of very, very late antiquity.
Uh-huh.
And that we have this chain of control dating back to around the sort of widespread adoption of Christianity. We can't push it back any further, but from the head that we had, which was in Constantinople, there's actually a pretty clear chain of what happens. So the head relic stays in Constantinople, and it's not until the 12th century that part of it, the face of the head, is taken and given to another monastery in Constantinople called the Studios Monastery. But shortly after that, Constantinople is captured by crusaders in the Fourth Crusade. And what they do is what their Byzantine predecessors have done, which is give away parts of relics, especially sort of the True Cross, and sort of subdivide these parts and give them away as gifts. And John the Baptist's head, as a very valuable commodity, is something that was very prized and something that emperors, these crusader emperors, gave out a lot. And the good thing about it is we have the medieval equivalent of sort of gift receipts that were sent with all of these little pieces, and they all survive. So all right. I was able to track down a whole list of how this one head of John the Baptist is divided up all over Europe. That part, that face bit that was split off, was taken to the cathedral in Amiens by a crusader by the name of Wallon of Sartone. Another part of the, probably the back of the head, was given to Venice. A small unspecified piece of the head was brought back by a crusader named Robert of Clary to the monastery of Corbie in Picardy. The top of the head was given to Louis IX, King of France, along with the other passion relics, the Mandolin of Edessa, the Crown of Thorns, things like that, and was in Paris. And then we have all these little bits that were sent around. So John the Baptist's teeth were sort of divided up. One tooth went to the Archbishop of Thessalonica, one to the monastery of Fompin in northern France. One was brought back by a guy named Henry of Ulme to Heisterbach. A tooth, along with his thumb, was given to the Abbey of Salzine. Some of his hair and the part of the wood that he was beheaded on was given to the Bishop of Beauvais. We even have a gift receipt for his eyebrow, which was sent to Clairvaux. And what you have is just, you can see how this one relic gets chopped up into smaller and smaller pieces and given up and given as pieces of the head of John the Baptist. And because medieval tradition was to take small relics and put them in big reliquaries, so you have a big bust, a gold bust of John the Baptist's head, and then inside that is a small bit of his head, it looks like his head is in all these places. But if you look at it, they only have these little pieces, which have all been sort of subdivided up. Mm-hmm. And so what looks like a hydra is really very, I guess, practical economizing, getting the most you can, the most benefit you can, making as many friends as you can with one head.
Yeah, well, it is amazing. It's also sort of amazing that there seem to be more relics related to John the Baptist than to even Christ himself, although I suppose the resurrection means that, you know, it's even harder to argue for Christ's relics.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a big part of it. The other thing is that for the most part, the relics that have to do with the passion are jealously guarded. First by
the emperor. Let's remind the buzzkillers what the passion was.
Okay, that's Jesus's death on the cross. And so when Saint Helena goes on sort of her relic hunting mission, that she finds not only the cross, but sort of all the implements that are mentioned in the gospel accounts, things like the crown of thorns, the cloak put on Jesus, the pillar that he's scourged at, the spear he's poked with, the sponge that wine is put up to his mouth, in parts of the rock from his tomb, that all of these pieces are jealously guarded by the emperors in Constantinople. And then later, these are sort of given en masse by the crusaders who take Constantinople to the kings of France, who hold them up until the French Revolution, at which point most of them, with the exception of some bits of the cross and the crown of thorns, are lost. But what's left is now in Notre Dame. But But these relics, the reason they're not, that you don't see too many pieces of them, is just because they're so precious that they're rarely given out. Sometimes what's done is that a thorn from the crown of thorns is given out.
Right.
Like you'd never give someone half the crown of thorns. So like you would with bones to sort of break them apart.
Right. So what fascinates me is that, you know, this story is very, very complicated. There are all these things that can be traced and seem to be traceable, and then there are things that have been obviously made up, and other scholars have come and pieced together certain things and found that they can't exist. But so you can't exactly say with any great deal of confidence that all the relics are fake or all the relics are true. You know, it's a complex story.
Yeah, and there are some stories that professional historians just can't tell in their fullest extent. All I can do is piece together the historical evidence that we have. And in some cases, it's an open and shut case that St. Francis is in Assisi.
Yeah.
I can't tell you, though, that the Crown of Thorns that's in Paris today, if you go to Notre Dame, is the same cross that Jesus wore. There just isn't a continuous chain of historical evidence. I can push that chain back far. And with a lot of these ancient relics, you can push these chains back far. But getting all the way to Jesus and the early apostles is a very rare thing for there to be historical evidence to do. So at some point, we've got to say, we've done the most we can do with our job. Let's hand it over to the scientists, hand it over to the priests, or sometimes just hand it over to faith.
Yes. Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. What we always like to say on the show is things are complicated. The more you look into these things, they're often very, very, very complex. Professor, you've outlined that for us so nicely and so completely. Thank you very much. We'd love to have you back on the show sometime. Would that be all right?
Yeah, sure. Maybe they're getting a little great. Bored of me by now, but a couple months. Who knows?
Okay, well, thanks again, and over and out, Buzzkillers. Killers.